Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host today is Dave Allen, as we bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. It is Monday, April 13th, 2020. Good afternoon, Dave.
Good afternoon, Melody.
Monday it is, and hope you had a nice weekend.
Absolutely.
And we are back, and we have a nice day in gold today. So we'll talk a little bit about gold here, but gold is up $29, $1,715 of the New York spot price after market. Had a high of $1,729. So a pretty nice day. Couldn't hold it, but $29 for gold. Silver was up 3 pennies at $1,552. Struggled a little bit in early morning trade, but it turned around. Platinum was down a dollar at $755. Palladium was up 77 at $2,284. The dollar was down 0.09 at 99.40. Crude oil was down 0.02 at 22.74. Boy, it's really a good thing that they made this huge announcement on all the cutbacks in oil prices for, you know, I think it was up a little bit. I don't know what Brent did, but WTI is down 0.02 at 22.74. So, let's see. And the paper markets today was a weird day. I don't know if you noticed, Dave, but the Dow was down like 455 points and pretty much just stayed there. I mean, it didn't move. If it moved very little. And it wasn't that there were down limits or anything like that. And then, of course, in the last, you know, hour, half hour of trade, it went from 455 back to 328 to the downside. And I don't know if it was lower than 455 points earlier in the day, and it came back gradually. But every time I looked at it, it looked like it was a 455 to the downside.
Brent crude, rather, by the way, was up about 2% at $32 a barrel.
All right. And so it was a little bit odd on the Dow today. The NASDAQ was up 38 points at 8,192. Big reversal there also. They were all in the negative territories today. The S&P was down 28 at 2,761. 10-year yield, 0.75%, down 0.01. June contract, I believe this is June contract. Let's see. June. Where's June? June, 1765. 1765 for June contract. And a lot of buyers, wholesalers, are actually using June contracts to price coins. And where they'll find, or the London Exchange. At least one time there used to be one major exchange. Now there's a whole bunch of them, and I think they kind of go to the one that's presenting the highest number. But so, you know, it's always adjusting. The let's go back. And Japan was down a little over 2%. European markets were up over 2%. And you know, as much as there is in the news, it seems like, again, it's the same news. It's kind of like we're in Groundhog Day. You know, that movie. Wasn't it? I think, was that the name of that, Dave? Groundhog Day or Groundhog, whatever, with Bill Murray in there, where he just keeps reliving the same day over and over and over again. It's like, yeah, that's where we've been. And so there's been a lot of news, but of course all the news is, you know, focused on the one thing, virus, but they're ignoring all the other stories that are out there. And Dave, before we go on, I just want to mention this one where you have firms that are actually offering bankruptcy 101, bankruptcy 101 sessions as defaults projected to skyrocket. Moody's Investor Service and Fitch Ratings expect defaults to more than double in the next year as the coronavirus pandemic weighs on businesses. You have supply chains that are being that were interrupted and retail operations closed, pushing companies to fire workers or put them on leave. You have investment firms and businesses are preparing for the months ahead, but after more than 10 years of growth, You got a lot of these guys, you know, they've never lived through a downturn. Isn't that sad? Here it is. A lot of these guys, that's how young they are. They've never lived through a downturn before, and they lack the experience of the great financial crisis to lean on. Now, how scary is that? That's who's managing your money. Now, that should make you feel a little bit more, you know, comfortable and confident of your retirement accounts and your pension plans. And to prepare asset managers and company executives are reaching out to law firms and financial advisors for a refresher course on restructuring and bankruptcy. According to Leonard Glimbaum, a partner in the finance group at law firm Ropes and Gray, said there are a lot of clients who have not been through a down cycle. Gee, and they're asking, how is this going to play out? I mean, I don't know. The law firm, they said it's the first time for a lot of people, so there is some historical education. Every downturn is different, but a lot of the playbooks are similar, so they're spending a lot of time educating people. Lawyers at Goodwin Procter have been asked by investors to run bankruptcy 101 sessions about distressed investing and bankruptcy. This is according to Howard Steele, a partner in the financial restructuring practice at the law firm. He says, we've had a bull run, and again, a lot of the new participants, they've never had a bad day in their life, ladies and gentlemen, and they get to have their first bad day in their life on your money. So I can't think that anyone out there that is watching this unfold believe that any of their funds and their retirement and pension plans are safe by holding paper. Trillions and trillions of dollars are being spent. There's more and more reports, and going back to, doesn't matter if we all went back to work tomorrow. Well, we're still working here at Discount Gold. But if everybody went back tomorrow, the damage has been done. They're going to have to create trillions and trillions of dollars more. Whether they buffalo everybody into thinking that it's infrastructure spending or what. Well, it'll always be for your best benefit because that's the only way it'll get bought and sold. It just even. And there's plenty of information out there. If you just start looking, things are not going to. And yeah, you hear both sides of the story. There's a lot of disinformation, a lot of propaganda out there, just a lot of opinions and a lot of non-truths. But use a little common sense. I think most of us that at least are listening to this program and have retirement accounts and pension plans, we know how to do math the old way. It isn't the fuzzy math that President Bush talked about. One and one still equals two. And this thing is going to play out based on that. Reality will strike. In coming months, many professionals will continue to lean on colleagues and advisors that worked during the 2008 financial crisis. Everybody's looking. This is not the 08 and 09 recession. This is totally different. And so what they go back and rely on 2008 and 2009, I mean, maybe the jury is still out on whether this is going to be much worse than 2008 and 2009, or is the jury still out? I don't think it is. So you better get and cash. Oh, hold cash. You want to hold cash. No, you don't. I'm not a financial planner. That's my opinion. You want to hold some cash. And everybody goes back to 19 during the Depression, the Great Depression. Oh, you want to hold cash. Cash was king during the Great Depression. Yeah, it was. You're right. Cash was king. But cash was gold. It wasn't paper. I don't think you can even compare what we're going to be facing to the Great Depression. So cash was gold. You know, I mean, do you really believe that with all the trillions of dollars that's being printed, that the dollar is going to continue to buy the same thing as it did? That we're going to continue to have that real little inflationary number, that little imaginary inflation number that likes to be produced by the government and the Fed? I mean, good grief. You know, and it's just like, and I hear this stuff all day long, and Dave, sorry about this, but all day long I'm reading, and I hear these comments, and I hear comments, I get things that are sent to me, and it's just like, wake up. What is wrong with everybody? I mean, it just gets more bizarre and more bizarre. Focus on the things that you really know. Use some common sense. The picture is not pretty. Anyway, that's my opening for today, folks. And that's what I get to these programs, and then I just get started, and then I just get all fired up. Everybody wants to debate me. Don't, you know, I shouldn't say don't debate me. Please do. But you got to listen to what I have to say also. Debates in today's world, it's either one or the other way. Everybody has earphones on or earplugs in, so you can't hear the other person talk. And I think when people do a lot of their own research, they just go to everybody that they already know what they're going to say and support your opinion. How can you find your way through anything if you just go to the venue that tells you the same thing that you think that you believe? There's a lot of great information, yes, but, you know, challenge yourself. Good grief. I think, Dave, we just need to have this segment, Good Grief. My Good Grief segment. But anyway, so yes, I'm fired up. And we'll talk a lot about things today. I don't know, Dave. It's just amazing what's going on in these financials. I mean, you have the slaughterhouses that are getting shutdowns. Okay, we talk about the interruption of supply chains of our food. Regardless of what you think, this is happening. So, you know, it's Smithfield. It's closing the facility until authorities clear it to reopen. Said it would be impossible to keep stores stocked if plants aren't running. Production of meat is already slowing in the U.S. In the week ended April 11th, pork output of 518 million pounds dropped by 6% from the previous week, while beef production of 444 million pounds slumped by nearly 15%. This is from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The closure in South Dakota adds to virus-related disruptions elsewhere in the food chain. Tyson Foods, pork plant in Iowa, JBS beef plant in Pennsylvania. Two workers at a Georgia poultry plant died from the virus. Disruptions. I'm not even sure I'd want to eat meat anymore. If people are sick handling the meat and so forth, I don't know. I'm just saying. But anyway, let me get back on track, Dave. I know you wanted to talk, you had information about the virus here today, giving the listeners some updates. One of the sad things, and we'll talk about later on in the program, is the, about violence. I mean, it's only natural that we're going to start seeing violence beginning to break out, and that's not a good thing either. But, so you had... See, where do you want to start, Dave? Let's go on a little bit. Let's talk about the OPEC that finalizes the 10% of the oil production cuts. Yesterday, OPEC, Russia, and other oil-producing nations finalized an unprecedented production cut of nearly 10 million barrels. That's one-tenth of global supply in hopes of boosting crashing prices amid the coronavirus pandemic and a price war. Mexico's engineer minister said on Twitter that the group of nations agreed to cut 9.7 million barrels a day beginning May 1st. Energy officials from other countries shared similar information. So how many are they going to cut totally, Dave?
Don't know.
They didn't. They just said that they're just going to cut
10 million barrels a day.
That's it? Oh, I guess I said that. Yeah, 10 million barrels. Didn't they say they needed like 30 million? For it to make any difference?
Well, some are suggesting that.
But the Saudi Arabia sharply criticized Russia days earlier over what it's described as comments critical of the kingdom, which finds itself trying to appease the U.S. President Trump, which is, of course, is or was a longtime OPEC critic.
Yeah, you even have some U.S. senators warning Saudi Arabia. These are Republicans. Find a way to boost prices as... Here it is. We talked about this last week as American shale firms face far higher production costs. These senators, many of whom represent, I shouldn't say represent per se, but certainly represent states in which a lot of these oil shale mining activities have been going on now for the past couple of years. It's led to the U.S. Becoming the number one oil producer in the world almost. So now U.S. senators from those states are finding it certainly in their best interests to prop up those American shale firms. Now, we know also American troops have been deployed to Saudi Arabia for the first time since the September 11th attacks over concerns of retaliating for, you know, from Iran over various regional tensions and events. Kevin Cramer, who's a Republican senator from North Dakota, said that they've spent over the last month waging war on American oil producers while we're defending theirs, referring to Saudi Arabia. This is not how friends treat friends. Now, Iran's oil ministry says it's already cut roughly 10 million barrels for May and June.
Hey, we're going to pick up there when we come back because this is really important. And I can't believe there's no word anywhere, Dave, about American troops being deployed to the kingdom. At least I haven't heard that. Maybe I wasn't looking for that. But that's, to me, that's a very important thing to continue on and about this. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Please stay tuned.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Please make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com. dgscoins.com, and make sure you sign up for our weekly newsletter. And I am hoping, one's going out today, but I am hoping next week we'll get back on track to have that market report in there. And so we'll get you updated on that. And any other announcements, Dave, that you can think of? We do have some, we did get some American Gold Eagles in, but premiums are hefty. We have buffaloes, we have kangaroos, we have kangaroo silver. They're not too bad. We still have 90% silver, so there is product for you, ladies and gentlemen. So give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. Heading into the break, we were talking about the Saudis and looking all the OPEC members looking to cut production. Dave, do you want to pick up where you left off?
Well, I mean, it looks as though there might be about 3,000 American troops in Saudi Arabia now. Of course, that move came after the Saudi oil fields were bombed. But Nigeria, who's a player here in OPEC, their petroleum resource ministry said that the other cuts would stand in the deal, which means an 8 million barrel a day cut from July through the end of this year, and a 6 million barrel cut for 16 months, beginning next January 1st. And they say that will enable the rebalancing of the oil markets and the expected rebound of prices by another $15 over the short term. So we'll see.
You know, Dave, Mexico had initially blocked the deal, but Obrador, Mexico's president, he had said on Friday that he agreed with President Trump that the U.S. will compensate what Mexico cannot add to the proposed cuts. The Kremlin said that Putin held a joint call with President Trump and President Trump. He's a trooper, President Trump and Saudi King Salman, to express support of the deal. It also was said he spoke separately with Trump, in which they continued to discuss the oil market situation, of course, as well as other issues. But others still worry it may not be enough. This is at least a temporary relief for the energy industry and for the global economy. But this industry is too big to be let to fail, and the alliance showed responsibility with this agreement. Here's our favorite, Dave, buybacks. Buybacks and dividends. And it seems that excessive stock buybacks can, we have the analogy of the story of the three little pigs. I'm not good at analogies, but the first little pig invests minimal time and effort and builds a house of straw, which the big bad wolf comes along and then he blows it down. It turns out that excessive stock buybacks can be like building a house of straw. And today's big bad wolf is the worldwide pandemic and its economic consequences. And in a share buyback, a company goes into the market and buys its own shares at the prevailing market price from a willing seller, and then retires those shares, reducing the number of shares outstanding and driving share prices up. That's to lure all those who buy on dips and everything. It could be the companies are buying back their shares because they lack productive ideas for growth. and it is better for the economy to reallocate capital than to invest in unproductive ideas. In some cases, buybacks move money from businesses with plenty of capital to other areas of the economy. And economic theory assumes that those selling shareholders reinvest that capital into new opportunities, of course, with higher potential future returns. If GM did a buyback, for an example, an investor might choose to sell their shares into the buyback and then take the proceeds to invest maybe in Tesla, Dave?
That's theoretically true. We know that while buybacks can encourage investors to move their money elsewhere, over-distribution of capital leads to a lack of financial flexibility for the company. It's one of the consequences, unintended or not. And that can create destructive short-term behavior, especially in a challenging economic environment like the one we're in right now. Now, recent research shows that over-distribution of capital, and that's really a simple equation, the distribution of cash, that's in excess of free cash flow. That's a factor clearly associated with lower long-term value creation. Distributions to investors, well, in the form of buybacks and dividends, in excess of free cash flow are associated with weaker return on invested capital. Almost 40% of global companies exceeded their free cash flows with issuances in 2018, and they underperformed their peers in terms of the return on invested capital, ROIC, by 26%. That's big time, ladies and gentlemen. Now, dividends like buybacks aren't a problem necessarily. In fact, many retail investors count on them, paper investors count on them for income. And dividend yield certainly is an important investment consideration, especially if a company is very volatile or their price has been suppressed for a period of time. Now, in the U.S., the Stimulus 3.0 package, the CARES Act, requires companies that receive government aid to halt stock buybacks and dividends for a year after they stop getting this aid. Now, this is likely, you know, going to check certain industry where buybacks have run rampant the last 5 years, at least while they're getting taxpayer assistance. While stronger than straw, companies that pay excessive dividends may also not be able to withstand that dreaded wolf at the front door.
So they can still do the buybacks while they're getting the aid, but only they have to stop after. Or
No, it's both.
Okay.
While they get the aid and a year after they receive it.
Okay. But the Fed can go in there and buy the assets. So, you know, they can't do it, but the government and the Fed can.
Well, how about that?
Yeah.
Win-win.
Yeah. You have a win-win and a loser. Like the tail, it seems unfair that those who are irresponsible and didn't plan for the future, and we talked about those folks, are bailed out by those who were more diligent and managed their risk better. And of course, no one predicts this global pandemic, but we certainly have predicted a global recession, depression was coming our way. We just didn't know what the catalyst was. So we get the same feeling of inequity when we see companies that have over-distributed their capital seeking these bailouts from taxpayers. Surprisingly, just 48% of the much-maligned airline industry and 41% of the oil and gas industry exceeded their cash flow with buybacks and dividends in 2018. Companies in the railroads and trucking, 72%. Electric utilities, 71%. Industries over-distributed their capital with far more frequency. But the amount of buyback continues to be big. Although buybacks fell in 2019 to around $750 billion and are down again so far in 2020, the 500, get this number, folks, the 500 largest U.S. companies spent $3.2 trillion on buybacks over the last 5 years. What's more, the top 20 companies accounted for nearly a third of this total, with Apple alone accounting for 8%. More than half of all buybacks were financed by debt, by corporate borrowing. So, looks like a lot of risk to me, Dave.
Well, indeed. I mean, governments and private companies all around the world are now struggling with how to both manage the current crisis and also position themselves to grow and to be resilient once the crisis eases, whenever that may be. As policy makers and executives consider their decisions in this challenging time, we ask them to continually ask themselves, is this the right decision for the long term? How many of them can see beyond their quarterly or annual bonus, for example? And that's not meant tongue-in-cheek whatsoever. In particular, decision makers all around the world could ensure that, like in the U.S., companies who receive aid don't over-distribute their capital, as a litmus test, having buybacks that don't exceed cash flow over a three-year period, at least. This leaves the option open for companies that have managed their capital responsibly and preclude other firms from making, decisions that lead to being blown away by the next wolf at the door.
But from what I was reading on this, the billions of dollars that these corporations are supposed to get, that there's no transparency whatsoever. Supposedly there was a check factor or money factor or whatever you want to call them appointed. They were canned and somebody else was appointed to follow how this money is dispersed. But nobody really knows what companies and how much they're going to get. That doesn't have to be released, or how they even spend it. I mean, supposedly, so how would they know that they're not going in there and buying back their shares? Would it just be on their corporate returns or their...
Yeah, that's on their corporate returns. But, this was a point of contention that led to a delay in the CARES Act being finalized. I mean, it was finally... It's in there, even though the administration is pushing back on it, but there is a provision in there that requires the names and amounts of aid that these companies are getting. And that was supposed to have been enforced, essentially, by an independent inspector general, who, of course, was fired last week, but also by a so-called Congressional Oversight Committee, composed of, I believe, five members of Congress. So I don't get. It looks like everything's slow in the uptake here, Melody.
So it just kind of seems it depends on how bad it is. If it's really, really bad, then there's not going to be any. Just do what you need to do to keep this going. Or if it doesn't turn out to be as bad as what everyone is anticipating, then they'll take names and tabs and so forth. I don't know, but it is. And then we talked briefly about this last week about how this is beginning to hit cities and states, Dave. And I think you wrote an article about it that'll be in our newsletter today.
Well, that's true. I mean, America's economic crisis is expanding to its states, cities, and towns. State and local tax revenue is falling, particularly in areas heavily dependent on sales taxes, while spending is up due to added unemployment and Medicaid obligations. Take Arizona, for example, which is near the middle of the pack when it comes to sales tax, at least as a percentage of total state revenue. It had been projecting Arizona a $1 billion budget surplus by the end of its fiscal year, which ends this June 30th. It's a $1 billion surplus, but it now expects a $1.1 billion deficit. Well, that's for the year ending 2021. They didn't specify how that initial $1 billion projection for the end of this year is going to end up, but going from plus 1 billion, which probably would have been enacted a year ago for implementation July 1st, to 1.1 billion in the red for the end of next year. And Arizona has a relatively large rainy day fund, That's essentially, you know, unused surplus funds sitting around in some investment accounts. But it's certainly not enough to cover the likely tax shortfall that they're facing. Then there's Nevada, which is more reliant on the sales tax than any other American state. Not surprising due to, one, its lack of income tax, but two, Las Vegas and Reno and the gaming industry and tourism in general. Grand Canyon, Hoover Dam, and of course Las Vegas again. On Friday, Nevada Governor Steve Sisolak asked all state agencies to prepare budget cuts of up to 4% for the current fiscal year, ending at the end of June, 3 months away, and between 6 and 14% for next fiscal year, which begins July 1st. The most critical states may be Florida and Louisiana, both of which are in the top 10 for sales tax dependency, and both of which have rainy day funds that represent less than 5% of annual expenditures. We call that a thin margin, indeed, especially in down economic times, Melody.
Yes, for sure. And both of these states, you know, they've been hit hard by the virus. Louisiana is believed to have peaked last week, but Florida isn't expected to peak for a couple of more weeks.
Well, that's what we're hearing indeed. I mean, they also have large tourism and oil industries and are at particular risk for hurricanes, opening the possibility of multi-state emergencies later this summer and fall. I mean, even states with relatively low sales tax are going to experience revenue declines and are already doing so, particularly as layoffs eat into income tax revenue and some residents and landlords and ladies are unable to pay their property taxes. There are also going to be shortfalls in cities, counties, and towns, many of which haven't yet debated or approved next year's budget because of state enabling laws and local ordinances that didn't anticipate the extent of the coronavirus pandemic, certainly, and anticipating governing via mass shutdowns.
Well, you mentioned the risk for hurricanes, and already you're beginning to read predictions of a very heavy hurricane season because how warm it is in the Gulf. And we certainly have experienced the big storm that came up through the south, up through the east yesterday, and overnight we experienced it this morning. And quite a few people have been killed because of the tornadoes. I mean, it was just incredible to watch the Weather Channel and see where, I mean, it was just one line of tornadoes that was just going up the East Coast.
Just so we're gonna, what we need, Melody, another disaster relief season.
So we'll be back here in just a few minutes, and then we're going to talk about cities and states in bankruptcy. We'll be right back.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen. Heading into the break, we were talking about the cities and counties and towns and the states that are going to have shortfalls due to lack of tax revenue. And, you know, going through the Great Recession of 2008, there was some cities that did file bankruptcy. They did set a precedence. I don't think it had ever happened before. So now you're talking and you're writing about, Dave, that these bankruptcies are very, you know, they're going to continue. It's very real.
Well, that's right. I mean, states aren't usually obligated to bail out a city in its state if it goes under. But they tend to do so anyway because of the signal it would send if they didn't. And also because the implications of letting one of their cities, however big or small, fail. But if suddenly a lot of them in the same state needed help all at the same time, would any state be able to afford it? Any? It's very, very doubtful. Brookings recently analyzed the immediate fiscal impact of COVID-19 on cities, including tax types and at-risk jobs, and found that four of the top five cities were in Ohio. Let's see, cities like Cincinnati, Columbus, Toledo, Akron, and Cleveland. That's five out of the top 20. There are also these ancillary or peripheral public entities, universities, transportation systems, even water and sewer systems in some cases. A lot more of them now are privatized. But the university and transportation systems in particular are hemorrhaging revenue. At the same time, they're being asked to cut budgets. They're getting it on both ends, and it's a struggle to keep operating in any kind of effective matter, or with effective outcomes, I should say.
Well, you know, Dave, you would think after the Great Recession that all these state governments would have, you know, some sort of economic crisis plan, but now they're just beginning, or they've just begun.
Well, you know, that's a good. I mean, I'd like to follow up on that at some point to look into that. It's really surprising because after 9/11, there was a national move afoot led by the National League of Cities and Counties and also the International City Managers Association. And together that represented, you know, they represented workers and elected officials in every last local municipality in the entire country. And, you know, under the National Incident Management System, NIMS it was called, to receive any kind of federal aid, municipalities of, I think, virtually all shapes and sizes were required to implement this command system for future emergencies, not just terroristic in nature, but for hurricanes and natural disasters, and a case like this. So hearing that and seeing that does raise a question, but it does appear that many local governments, state governments, were either slow to recognize the problem with the coronavirus, or more than likely, their attention was, you know, preoccupied by the immediate health care issues to their workers and to their residents. So the initial response, like in Nevada, is going to be state steep budget cuts, with officials and researchers saying that education, particularly K-12 education, is likely to be first or among first on the chopping block. Many of these education-related cuts will be immediate in their application to the current fiscal year. And then again, because both states are legally required to balance their budgets. So also expect various budgeting gimmicks that we see every year, such as pulling some 2021 taxes backward into 2020 to fill any gaps, and or extending the 2020 fiscal year from, say, June 30th to December 31st with an 18-month fiscal year, as New Jersey just did.
So can we do that on our taxes?
Yeah. No, don't think so. Great idea, though. You should run for office.
I mean, like, what difference does it really make?
Well, it really is pay me now or pay me later. That's really what it is. I think it's like, well, let's get an extra 6 months of revenues in next year's fiscal year, and then we hope for the best that life sort of gets back to normal after that. Now, you know, and a lot of cities and states are gonna likely try to issue new bonds or refinance existing ones. We'll see. I mean, it had become difficult even before this crisis to find buyers for local general obligation bonds. But I see a lot of that coming regardless of how much the Fed decides to actually buy for their ever-expanding portfolio.
Do you think they'll do that? Do you think the federal government, the Treasury, or Fed will do a government bond, the Liberty Bond, or like they did after the war during the war to help finance it? I'm not quite sure. I think it was wasn't it the Liberty Bond or Freedom Bond or something?
I don't think so. I mean, there are some calls for that now, but I'd be surprised. Perhaps if this lingers for a long period of time, we might see that. But you know, so the federal government's been trying to de-emphasize its savings bonds program for a number of years now, and this essentially would work more like that. And I don't think they're close to doing that. But I did see that it had been discussed among some Treasury officials in the last couple of weeks.
But we know the Fed has issued the CARES Act, and it's included billions and billions of dollars for the state and local governments.
Just 150.
Oh, is that all?
And, of course, no one thinks that's enough. And you know, relative to other sectors, it almost certainly isn't. We see, I mean, last year, the state and local sector contributed 8.5% of GDP. The federal sector surprisingly contributed just 3.8%. Now, that's not necessarily a good reason to figure out or to decide whether or not $150 billion or $500 billion or whatever in bailout money is enough. I think the more important thing is to figure out how are the fiscal capacities of the state and local governments going to be when we're through the virus, and sort of react accordingly as a plan to keep municipalities out of bankruptcy. But the bottom line is, look, individuals and companies were the first to feel the economic pain of COVID-19, but they may just be the tip of the spear. State, county, and city governments and their taxpayers, us, are next. Translation, ladies and gentlemen, we're in line with no 6-foot barriers. whether we want to be or not.
Make sure you get the newsletter today. Sign up at the website, dgscoins.com. Well, you know, there's a lot of trade officials here in the U.S. and even in the EU that, you know, are kind of far apart about whether production should move home or not. You know, certainly we've seen these supply shortages on both sides of the Atlantic. The European Commissioner's Director General for Trade said that moving supply chains home is inefficient. Self-sufficiency is not an option for any country. Really? It's not an it's not an option even for any continent, she said last week during a webinar. Actually, and it was hosted by the Washington International Trade Association. So, am I reading that? Am I reading that correctly?
Yes.
Okay. Pinch me. Make sure. Depending on the model, they contain as many as 900 pieces sourced from all over the world to make supply chains resilient. It's best to involve as many countries as possible and diversified, she argued. And of course, that is far different than what President Trump wants. And of course, even us, the people of this country, think. You know, we think everything should be made here. We need manufacturing to come back to this country. I don't think it is, but I mean, we need it here. It's best. We're better for it when it's here. And, of course, we know that President Trump invoked the Defense Production Act to direct manufacturing of medical equipment and is mulling an executive order that would cede to reshore the making of U.S. medical supplies. It might come as a government act, Dave, but I don't think any of them are going to do it voluntarily.
Oh, virtually none. Virtually none. I mean, this push apparently has support from a bipartisan group of members of Congress. And they've been talking about this kind of legislation to implement right after the crisis is over. Peter Navarro, you know, Trump's pick to coordinate domestic supply policy during the coronavirus. Excuse me one second. I'm sorry. He went on 60 Minutes last night and blamed America's dependency on globalization for its shortages. And he said, if we made it here, we wouldn't be faced with this. He called it the original sin. Said still there might be a meeting of the minds further down the road. They say that should come when it's time to take a look at and potentially roll back the subsidies that major economies handed out to stem the health and economic crisis, especially if they concern China.
All right. We don't want to talk about that. We know, how much time do we have left? We just about have three minutes left of the program. And I mentioned in the beginning of the program, we're going to talk a little bit about the domestic violence and how that is rising. And again, the U.S. tracks the mounting death toll of the virus, but there's another list of casualties. And of course, it's victims of domestic violence. And there have been experts that have been warning that domestic violence would increase during the outbreak. Victims are forced to shelter with abusers and crucial support services, such as courts, shelters, and even other family members who serve as a type of protective shield from violence. They're kind of out of reach. So now there are some preliminary warning signs that lethal domestic abuse is already on the rise. In an average week in the U.S., around 11 murder-suicides occur. The vast majority of murder-suicides is, of course, when somebody kills somebody else and then themselves, usually with an intimate partner or family. And between March 27th to April 2nd, as the majority of states ordered the public to stay home, there were at least 19 murder-suicides, including four attempted ones. Almost all the incidences involved a man killing his wife or child before taking his own life. You know, it's likely additional incidents exist, Dave.
Yeah, I guess the experts are warning that it's too early to tell if the crisis, the coronavirus crisis, has ushered in a statistically significant increase in these fatal acts of domestic violence. Intuitively, it certainly makes sense. But paired with the spike in calls to hotlines and surging gun sales across the country, many are fearing the worst in that regard. This is interesting. James Allen Fox, who's a criminology professor at Northeastern University, said several years ago, a colleague facetiously said, if you want to reduce crime in the streets, you take away the streets. And that's essentially what we've done with the virus. We've seen a drop in violence between strangers. At the same time, when you put people close together, there's a greater opportunity for conflict. So one would anticipate that domestic homicide and murder-suicide would increase in this kind of situation. Pretty sad stuff, Melody, but reality bites, and I think it's an important piece of news to bring to our listeners.
You know, it truly is, and I would think that some of these shelters and so forth, I would think that they would stay. I mean, they are pretty much essential. I can't imagine that they'd be shut down, that there should always be a place for someone to go. Mm-hmm. And those who do violence on the street, if they're not in the street, they'll do it in the home. Anyway, be safe out there, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll be back tomorrow. So until then, be safe, good night, and God bless.
Bye-bye.
I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.